Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of The Power Is Now Online Radio. My name is Eric Frazier. Thank you for joining us today online and on the telephone. It's a beautiful day in Pasadena, California, and a great day to talk to D. Michael Mickey Collins, Director of the FDIC Office of Women and Minority Inclusion. Folks, what can I tell you? This is how we roll on The Power Is Now. You are in for another incredible show. I'm excited about this interview and the great things that we're going to learn about the FDIC and the Office of Women and Minority Inclusion. Today's show is being sponsored by People's Bank, Banking Unusual. And on the line with me is their senior mortgage banker, Patty Goodspeed. Thank you, Patty, for sponsoring the show today. Well, folks, I spent some time getting to know Patty. And if you're looking for a mortgage banking professional to serve your clients, you need to call Patty Goodspeed. And you're going to find out why in just a few minutes. I'm just back from the NAREP conference in Los Angeles. And if you didn't make it, you really missed a great conference. What I appreciate the most about these conferences are the friends that I make and, of course, the great connections that you can make there. The NAREP conference was jam-packed, folks, with information and classes and roundtables and even job opportunities. There's a lot happening at the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals, and I would encourage you to join your local chapter and attend the conferences. In fact, you should attend all the conferences. I am a proud member of the Orange County chapter of NAREP, the Orange County chapter of ARIA, the Asian Real Estate Association of America, and I'm also a member and president, the founding president, of the Orange County Association of Real Estate Brokers, also known as the Orange County Realtors, also known as the Orange County NAREP chapter. And I'm very proud to serve the National Association of Real Estate Brokers as the founding president in Orange County. And folks, I encourage you to check us out at ocrealtors.org, ocrealtors.org. Folks, there's a lot happening with all three minority trade associations. I encourage you to get involved. And there's also a lot happening right here on the Power Is Now online radio. Please tell your friends, as they want to learn more about the FDIC, they should join the Power Is Now online or by telephone right now. For those of you who are new to the Power Is Now online radio, the name and slogan, The Power Is Now, suggests that we maximize our potential for success in business and life when we act on information and opportunities now. The present is our future because the future is only a reflection of past decisions to act now. And what that means, folks, is that we are at our best and we maximize our success when we act now. That's our slogan, our theme of The Power Is Now. The Power Is Now online radio is an online radio network from which a series of teleconferences are created to empower, inspire, and educate consumers and real estate professionals about changes in the world of real estate, banking, finance, marketing, economics, government, and anything else that can give real estate professionals and consumers the tools they need to be successful. For questions and comments about The Power Is Now, please email eric.frazier@thepowerisnow.com, or you can contact me by telephone at 1-800-401-8994, extension 703. And if you're listening to the show for the first time, please go to thepowerisnow.com and become a member of the Power Is Now network for free. And on the Power Is Now website and also on Blog Talk Radio, you can listen to past shows and take advantage of special discounts and to other services that can help you grow your business. There is value in membership, and membership is free. It also adds you to our database for communication and notification about upcoming speakers. Well, folks, we're about to begin our interview, our conversation with D. Michael Collins, Director of the Office of Women and Minorities, in just a few minutes. We're going to take a break and share an interview I did with Patty Goodspeed, our sponsor today of the show. And this will also give you an opportunity, while you're listening to Patty, to tell other agents in your office and some of your friends that may not be with you, drop them a text, an email, a quick phone call, and let them know that the FDIC is on the line and that they should tune in and listen. I promise they will not be disappointed. They're going to thank you for telling them about this interview, and especially in learning something that might help them grow their business. So hang in there.
Hello, everybody.
We'll be right back.
Frazier with the Powers Now, and I'm with Patty Goodspeed, senior mortgage banker with People's Bank. Thank you, Patty, for sponsoring the show today with the FDIC.
Thank you for having me, Eric. I'm looking forward to learning a lot and engaging with the speaker.
So, Patty, tell us a little bit about People's Bank.
People's Bank is FDIC-insured bank. We are nationwide. We're a wonderful company, and our motto starts and ends with take care of grandma. So we definitely put everyone's needs first, and we want to create an environment that people are very comfortable working with and doing business in. Our tagline for People's Bank is banking unusual, and people often ask us, well, what does banking unusual mean? Banking unusual for us means we want to give you an unusual experience. We're not your typical cold banker. As you come in, you feel rigid about sharing your financials. We want to understand your situation, where you're coming from, and provide from your needs. Primarily, that's what People's Bank is all about. As a mortgage banker, I've been in this industry for 10 years, and I've learned a lot about people and what they need. And in the last few years, this industry has been insane. I take it upon myself now to really ensure that I listen to the needs of the people, the apprehensions that they have, and try to answer questions and be able to provide a mortgage experience that's going to be unmatched elsewhere.
Everyone's goal is to have a mortgage experience that will leave them happy and not crying once the transaction is over. So often, especially in a purchase transaction, it can be very trying, very difficult. It can be a roller coaster up and down. Talk a little bit about the experience that your customers have in purchasing a home or using you as a lender to purchase their home, and the experience that real estate agents have, because our audience is practically 100% real estate professionals.
Definitely, yeah. That's a great question. Real estate professionals have one goal in mind. Let's close the transaction. They put in a lot of work ahead of time, taking a buyer out shopping, showing homes, presenting their listings. They do a lot of that. So once the file is in contract, the most important thing to them is close it fast, don't ask me a lot of questions. So that's the kind of experience I like to provide for realtors. You know, it's like you're the quarterback. You get, you know, pass the ball and let me go ahead and run into the end zone. And that's how I treat my transactions with real estate agents. Primarily because when we pre-approve a buyer, we do a lot of the legwork up front to ensure that when the file goes into contract, we're basically worrying about inspections, appraisals, and getting the deal closed. Our underwriting turn times are quick because we do that in-house. We do fund our loans as soon as our loan documents go out, which is a huge advantage for our realtors. In general, when a realtor calls us and says, hey, we need this borrower pre-approved, we'll do that for them in the same day, provide the approval letters for them in the same day, get them going and shopping. In the meantime, while they're shopping, we collect the documentation so that once they get into contract, it's really just a smooth transition from that point. And if we're closing a loan in 30 days, we think it takes too long. Our goal is always to beat the contract date by at least 5 days. That's kind of the experience that we like to provide. I always say, I'm Patty Goodspeed. I like things done yesterday, you know, so that's kind of my motto.
Well, that does say your name well, Patty Goodspeed. In fact, that's a great name, by the way, for a mortgage banker, because we want it done.
Thank you. I get that often.
So, Patty, really, that's incredible. You try to close every purchase transaction 5 days before the contract date. You're doing pre-approval same day. So you're telling me your typical turn time or close time from start to finish is less than 30 days on every purchase transaction?
Definitely. We definitely want to make the contract dates on a transaction. There are a few exceptions. Generally, because of our ability, we do get a lot of calls from listing agents, and they say, hey, Patty, this file has been going on for X amount of days. The lender is not you know, keeping up with us. They're not giving us updates. We don't know what's going on, or they can't get this deal closed. Can you do it? So when we get a deal like that, we are sometimes asking for extensions, because then we're already cut short because you've already had a lender working on it for 30 days. So in those particular instances, which are common, your listeners are probably going to, you know, identify with what I just stated. They're going to have lenders that oftentimes drop the ball. We get those calls, and when we get those calls, we do what we can as fast as we can. But yes, with FHA, VA, conventional purchases, home pass financing, the variety of different financing types, we're definitely going to be able to meet that 30-day mark, and we're fully staffed and capable of doing so. It's important in this type of market to be partnered with a lender that understands the importance of closing a purchase transaction on time. We know that the inventory is low. We know that agents are fighting through several offers to get their buyers in a contract. So once that contract comes in, it's like a hot potato here. We just move it fast, and we want to get it done as quickly as possible. So if we don't run into problems with the property or problems with the slow client who doesn't get their paperwork in a timely fashion, we're going to make sure that the agent's very happy and the deal closes early.
Patty, I'm impressed. This really sounds great. The sense of urgency, your fast turnaround time, all those things really fit well with the powers now. Now, I'm going to put you on the spot as a sponsor, because normally we ask this question of the guest to come on the show, and I'll be asking Michael this question as well. But what does the phrase, "the power is now," mean to you in the context of being a mortgage banker and getting things done?
Wow, I think that's a wonderful question, because one of my personal sayings, my mantras is, what better time than now? I don't feel like there's any better time than now to get something done. So where that fits into the conversation to, you know, real estate is that we're dealing in a time period to where realtors are focused on keeping asset managers happy. Realtors want to ensure their clients who have short sales that, hey, we're going to get this done before your home gets sold in an auction. We're dealing with buyers that are emotional because they, you know, want to believe that it can happen, but so much negative news out there, they don't believe it's possible. And so you have all these combinations of doubt and, you know, anxiety that take place in the transaction, and oftentimes people don't talk about it. So the importance of now is getting things done timely, answering the phone, answering questions, giving people a sense of, you know, urgency in the file, and making them feel comfortable that, hey, this file is important to me. I'm going to take your file and I'm going to close your file. I don't want you to worry about it. Get me what I asked for and we'll get it done. And the power is now, because now is everything. You know, if you're thinking about yesterday, you're not even focused on today. If you're thinking about tomorrow, you're missing details from today. So now is the most important thing. It's the only thing that we can control. So I focus on what's right now, and everything has to close right now or yesterday. So now is pretty important. it's like, we, you know, you work 8 months and you're showing a buyer a property, and you finally get him in the contract. When you pass that contract to your lender, you want to know that she's looking at it right now. You don't want to know that it's going to be on a list and she'll get to it in 4 days or 3 days, and then we're talking about 2 weeks for an appraisal and then another 6 weeks for a close. That's what the power of now means. When our clients submit an application to us or get a contract to us, we're looking at it right now. We understand the power of now.
Well, there is power in doing things right now, with immediacy, with urgency. And it sounds like People's Bank, Banking Unusual, fully understands what the power is now is all about. Patty, thank you so much for sponsoring today's show. Folks, if you're interested, if you're a real estate professional and you would like to sponsor a show on The Power Is Now, just contact me, eric.frazier at thepowersnow.com, and you too can make your case to our audience as to why you should consider your company, or why that you should be considered as a lender or as an agent in helping to close a transaction. Again, thank you, Patty, for being on the show today. And folks, we're going to transition now back to our main program and talk about the FDIC. So hang in there with us. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Again, People's Bank, Banking Unusual with Patty Goodspeed. Patty will be co-hosting with me today in the interview with Michael Mickey Collins with the FDIC. And so our subject today is the FDIC, Office of Minority and Women Inclusion, also known as OMNI. The OMNI came into existence as a direct result of Section 342 of the Dodd-Frank Act, Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010. And so Michael is going to talk about the primary functions of OMNI, the significance of the organization as it relates to Dodd-Frank and all the added responsibilities, the inclusion of women and minority-owned businesses and opportunities, how the FDIC internalizes its commitment to diversity, and the challenges the industry or the organization is facing in pursuing those goals. And, of course, we're going to be talking about upcoming business opportunities and special contracting opportunities at the FDIC. So there's a lot we're going to be talking about. I'm really excited about it, folks, and I certainly hope you're reaching out to your friends in the office and those who may not be with you. Let them know that we're about to engage in a great conversation with Mickey Collins. And so before we bring Mickey on the line, let me share a little bit about his background. D. Michael, also known as Mickey Collins, is director of the Office of Minority and Women Inclusion, also known as OMWI, for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. In this position, he is responsible for planning, directing, coordinating, conducting all activities associated with the execution of equal employment opportunities and diversity programs and operations. He provides oversight for the corporation's diversity strategic plan and initiatives and serves as chairman of the FDIC's Diversity Steering Committee. Prior to becoming director of OMNI, he was deputy for Equal Opportunity Office of the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Manpower, Reserve Affairs, Installation, and Environment, Washington, D.C. And in this position, he was responsible for providing guidance, direction, oversight of policies, plans, and programs affecting equal opportunity for all Air Force, military, and civilian personnel. He held this position from May of 1994 to June 1999. Additionally, from September of 2009 to May 11, he served as commissioner on the Presidential Military Leadership Diversity Commission. Mr. Collins was born in Camden, New Jersey, and graduated from Camden High School in 1964. He received a Bachelor's Arts degree in Political Science from Howard University in June 1969. He has pursued graduate studies in education at Howard and personnel management at Central Michigan University. He is a graduate of the Defense Race Relations Institute, the Academic Instructor Course, the Air Force Squadron Officer School, and the Air Command and Staff College. He is also a graduate of the Aspen Institute of Executive Seminars, the National Security Leadership Course, and the UCLA African American Leadership Institute. Mr. Collins was commissioned through the Air Force Reserve Officer Training Corps program at Howard University in 1969. In 1971, he was assigned as an instructor at the U.S. United States Air Force Special Operations Schools at Herbert Field, Florida. He was reassigned to Herbert Field Social Action Office in October 1971, where he served as the Wing Race Relations and Equal Opportunity Officer until 1973. In 1973, also, he was transferred to the Headquarters Tactical Air Command in Langley Air Force Base, Virginia, where he served as Chief Human Relations Education Branch. And from that point in the military, he has served as chief in a number of squadrons throughout the country, even in Northern Europe, and it was also Norway, where he served as deputy and commander of the AF North Support Group. And in his last military assignment, he served as Director of Academics at the Defense Equal Opportunity Management Institute and at Patrick's Air Force Base in Florida. He retired from the United States Air Force in the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, 1992, with more than 21 years of active service. And after retirement, he was a consultant who specialized in the delivery of client-centered training programs in all facets of cultural and workforce diversity. He worked extensively in public school systems throughout Florida, providing cultural awareness training to administrators, teachers, students, and parents. His military decorations include Defense Superior Service Medal, the Defense Meritorious Service Medal, 5 Air Force Meritorious Service Medals, the Presidential Unit Citation, 2 Air Force Outstanding Unit Awards, and the Air Force Recognition Ribbon and the Joint Meritorious Unit Citation. His awards include Outstanding Young Men of America Award, the Outstanding Staff Level Social Action Officer of the Year, the Tuskegee Airmen Appreciation Award, the Commander-in-Chief's Commendation from Headquarters from Allied Forces in Northern Europe, the Roy Wilkins Meritorious Service Award from the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and the National Guard Meritorious Service Award. In 1997, he received one of the NAACP's highest awards, the Benjamin L. Hooks Distinguished Service Award. He's also received the Department of Air Force Award of Meritorious Civilian Service, the Distinguished Civilian Service in 1999, and the National Image Chairman Award for Excellence in 2009 and 2010. His civic and professional affiliations include the NAACP, the Tuskegee Airmen, Inc., the Howard University Alumni Association, the Bison Express, and Sigma Phi Phi, a Pi Phi fraternity, of which him and I are fraternity brothers. Mr. Collins has a son, Jonathan Michael, a 2008 graduate of North Carolina AT&T State University. His favorite quote is, "Without a struggle, there can be no progress," Frederick Douglass. "And if everyone is thinking alike, then somebody isn't thinking," General George S. Patton. Thank you, Mickey, for joining us today on The Power Is Now. What an impressive background.
You almost put me to sleep, Eric. Didn't know you were going to go into that much detail.
Well, I tell you, I read it all, Mickey, because I'm so impressed. Man, you have done a lot, and you have been at this for a while. And it's no question in my mind why you were chosen to head this department of the FDIC, the Office of Women and Minority Inclusion. What a great role and a great responsibility, and it certainly seems to fall right in line with your background.
Well, yeah, I think I've been doing work in the EO and diversity and inclusion business for about 41 years now. So a lot of his longevity may be just been around a long time.
Well, you have, and I think because you've been around for a long time, it tells me that you can be very effective in what you're trying to achieve. When we look at the mission and the vision of this office, and you mentioned earlier to me about Maxine Waters, and I would like to learn really more about how this whole office came to be. We know that it's outlined in the Dodd-Frank Act, but there are many players, I believe, probably in making all of this possible. Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah. You're absolutely right. And Congresswoman Waters was the primary sponsor of Section 342 of Dodd-Frank. And, I think it was based on her experiences that happened back during the financial crisis of the late 80s, early 90s. And she saw then that minority and women-owned businesses and probably small businesses were not getting the kinds of opportunities for contract awards or the bid on some of the assets that were available. So as part of Dodd-Frank, she included this section, which basically established as the office, the OMWI office, is the Office of Minority and Women Inclusion, and wanted us to be the focal point for all matters in the agency that dealt with diversity in management, diversity in employment, diversity in our business activities that cover the gamut of things. So she was, I guess, she was the primary sponsor in the House, along with Congressman Barney Frank, and several members of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Well, I'm glad to know that. I think that our politicians, our representatives, don't get the credit they deserve for the work they do. Of course, if something's going on and that's controversial, they get all the credit in the world, right? But this is a positive thing, and it's bringing attention to that need for diversity and opportunity with minorities and with women. But we all know, Michael, or I'm going to call you Mickey, we all know that this is not going to last forever. The opportunities, especially created by this crisis, will not be around forever. And that really leads me to our Power Is Now statement. One of the things we do on this show, it's a tradition, we ask every guest to come on, what does the phrase, the power is now, mean to you in the context of who you are as a as an industry leader, as a government official, as director of this office, and in any other context you would like to choose, what does the phrase, the power is now, mean to you?
Well, you know, I think in looking at, you know, in the context of what I do from day to day here at the FDIC, I think the power is now really means, and I've observed this, that you have to take advantage of the opportunities that are available right now, because there's no guarantee that they will, you know, exist in the future. And if you don't take advantage of things when they're presented to you, you can be left standing at the door. And so it's basically, I think, a mindset of acting on opportunities that are there, and not being regretful later on, saying, I wished I had done that. So that's my view of really what the power is now is all about.
I tell you, living life too with regrets is a tough life to live, isn't it? I mean, when you know you should do something and you don't do it because of either procrastination or maybe a fear. And so I agree with you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's reluctance, you know, especially when you're talking about, the financial services arena, and there's no guarantees that the things you purchase or the engagements you get involved in are going to be successful. So there's always probably a little reluctance, and a little hesitation, but. You know, sometimes you have to just bite the bullet and jump out there and hope that, you know, everything comes out for the best and you've got the right skills and the right people that are working for you or with you, partnering with you to make things work.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right. Well, Michael, you have a very big job. I was observing the organizational chart and some of the other information you sent me about the operation. Thank you very much. It's an incredible, the FDIC in and of itself is an incredible organization within the government. And our first talking point is to talk about the primary functions of your office. But if you could just paint the picture for our audience and how big and broad the FDIC is and what they handle and manage.
Well, I mean, almost everybody knows, you know, what the FDIC does. You know, you go, you walk in your bank, you look on the front of the door, and it says your funds are insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
I mean,
that's the primary role, is to insure, the dollars that people have in our financial institutions. And our job is to ensure that the institutions are safe and sound and are, practicing best practices to keep your money safe and sound. So in order to do that, you know, one of our primary jobs is to do examinations of the institutions. And the bulk of the employees of the FDIC work in the examination process, either in safety and soundness, or on the consumer side of things. we have, I believe, 85 field offices around the country that have the responsibility for doing all the banks that are under our list of regulated entities. So our workforce is very dispersed, and like I said, more of our people are in the field than are in the headquarters or in our regional offices. But the primary job is to, you know, ensure that the banking system is safe. And I guess the FDIC mantra is that we've never, nobody's ever lost a dollar of their insured funds with the FDIC.
No, that's a great claim to fame of not only FDIC, but of the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
So we can't say that for perhaps other countries, can we? Especially with what's going on.
I don't think so. And you've got to know. I mean, our financial systems, our banking systems are probably, the most efficient in the world. And the FDIC in the last several years has been doing a lot more international work with other countries that, want to establish, systems that are similar to the ones that we use here in the United States and at the FDIC. So we're becoming a lot more international just by virtue of folks wanting to do that kind of stuff to ensure that their deposit insurance systems are set up and are coming into the 21st century.
Well, I think that a lot of agents, maybe just people in general, may not be aware that the FDIC is doing business. I mean, as a real estate professional, you can work with them, you can contract with them in helping to carry out the mandate, and there are many, to provide opportunity or to ensure that the banking system is working well, to help re-stabilize banks. There's a lot of opportunity, and I think it's fantastic that our government is officially reaching out for women and minorities so that this effort is truly diversified. We can't say that that's always been the case within the private sector. And thanks to Maxine Waters in that respect as well, a great deal of movement, positive movement has happened in that area as well in the private sector, getting on board with the importance of diversity in their networks and in their workplace.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's sometimes difficult to change old patterns and old habits. Sometimes the mindset when you talk about minority and women owned businesses or small businesses, is like, well, maybe they don't have the capacity, maybe they don't have the capabilities, maybe they don't have this, or maybe they don't have that. And, I think that, it's very easy to fall into that pattern and just say, well, I'll go with the same folks that, we've always done business with, and not really look to expand, their outlook, to expand their horizons. And, I think there are a lot of myths out there about, well, we can't find any, qualified minority or women-owned businesses to do this work. And, that's one of those myths that we have definitely broken down here at the FDIC and have been able to show that there are a whole lot of folks out there. I was surprised how many minority and women-owned firms are just in the financial services arena when you look around the nation.
Well, let's talk about those opportunities. Actually, before we do that, let's dive into our first bullet point, and that is the primary function of the office. And I was looking at the organizational chart. Give us kind of the size and the scope of your particular office and its function and what you do particularly to make all that happen.
Well, we're probably a little bit unique in our organization and our roles and responsibilities. here at the FDIC. When I say unique, among the financial services arena. See, I grew up in an environment where, a lot of times the equal employment professionals, the people that handled affirmative employment, and the people that handled diversity and inclusion were all in different buckets. You know, they all operated kind of independently, sometimes never talking to each other. And I've always been a firm believer that all of these functions around equal employment opportunity, equal opportunity, taking care of all the EEO laws and protections can work hand in hand with diversity and inclusion. So my staff is basically, I've got EEO professionals that do EEO complaints and process complaints that are filed by employees or applicants for employment. I have folks that look at all of our affirmative employment programs. In other words, they look at the numbers, count the beans, look at how we're doing with hiring and retention and recruiting and those kinds of things. And we have overall responsibility for our diversity and inclusion activities. I have 9 diversity councils around the country that help me do diversity-related work in the corporation. And the other thing we do is the outreach that we do to minority and women-owned businesses to increase those opportunities for minority and women-owned businesses and law firms to be involved in the FDIC's contracting and investment opportunities. So I have a number of different activities, but I think they all blend together. And that's how the structure of our OMWE office, has been. And basically, we were already pretty well organized before the OMWE mission was given to us. Our old name used to be the Office of Diversity and Economic Opportunity. So we changed the name based on the legislation. But a lot of the things that we were doing under the old name, we're doing under the new name. I have a good staff. I have a fairly substantial staff. I have about 34 people on board, and have a few more in the pipeline. So I have a good staff that's enables us to do all these varied missions, because we know that they all interconnect at some point.
Now, you bring up an interesting point, and that is OMWE has really always been in existence. It didn't come as a result of Dodd-Frank, but Dodd-Frank added more, really made that department even more powerful. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, yeah. I mean, there were functions out there.
Right.
But they were kind of disjointed. You know, some organizations didn't really have supplier diversity folks. They used their small business folks, to do everything around contracting. Some organizations, like I said, didn't have the diversity part and the EEO or affirmative employment parts talking to each other. And I think one of the things that 342 is going to do, I think, is going to pull a lot of those organizations and programs together, and I think they'll be a lot more effective because there'll be a lot more synergy, I think, among the different programs. But you're right. I think the 342 has given those additional responsibilities, and I think that will help us as we try to tie everything together.
So 342 is a section of the Dodd-Frank Act, and it outlines, I was reading that just the other day, and it really just kind of lays out the whole department and its function and its organizations, even your position as the director of the organization.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it lays it out pretty well. I mean, it's very precise about what the duties of the directors of the office will be, at what level they will be in the government service, You know, they're not political appointees. They're all career civil servants. And it, you're right. It's pretty specific on what we're charged to do.
So let's talk about some of the added responsibilities, one being, you know, the inclusion of minority and women. And I thought that was just an interesting, very long name for Department of the Federal Government. But it does get right to the point of what your core business is all about.
Yeah. Anything specific? Where do you want me to head? Okay.
Well, some of the significant added responsibilities of Dodd-Frank. I mean, you had
Yes. I think that when you look at the duties of the director, there's more emphasis on looking internally at the workforce diversity, and especially looking at the senior management of organizations. And again, I think there is a new emphasis on really getting minority and women-owned businesses involved in all the contracting opportunities, developing technical assistance for these businesses so that they can be competitive. Really, I mean, I basically said to level the playing field. And then I think, you know, looking at the diversity policies and practices of the entities that we regulate is really the brand new piece,
mm-hmm.
Which will require us to look at, you know, the 6,000 or so financial institutions that we regulate, and develop some kind of policies and practices around diversity in their workforces and diversity in their contracting. I think those are three things. And then I think the other piece that is added is, you know, looking at the diversity of the agency workforce to increase recruiting at HBCUs and Hispanic serving institutions and women's colleges and colleges that typically serve minority populations, sponsoring recruitment and job fairs in urban communities, advertising about employment opportunities, partnering with organizations that are focused on working with young minorities and women with internships and summer employment and full-time positions, and then partnering in inner cities and promoting with high schools and girls' highs and minority high schools to enhance financial literacy programs and provide mentoring. And, you know, I think those are those things. I mean, that's a pretty long list of things that have either been completely newly added or there's been a great deal more emphasis placed on accomplishing those duties.
Let's focus in on the real estate side of this, and I'm particularly interested in the fact you made an interesting point, 6,000 financial institutions that the FDIC is involved with from a regulatory standpoint, either they're benefiting or requiring FDIC insurance or some aspect of it. So I guess anyone that is any bank, particularly a bank that is FDIC insured, they have to be concerned about these new policies and this new emphasis about minority and women inclusion in their workforce and also in the business opportunities. And I'm also wondering, though, the private sector. If a private company is doing business with the FDIC or doing business with a bank insured by the FDIC or buying bulk assets from the FDIC or from a bank or from a GSC with the FDIC, they should also be under that same kind of scrutiny about the diversity in their networks and the inclusion of women and minorities.
Yeah, I agree with you, but it's a lot easier to say than to make it really – to make it so, and that is one of the big issues that we're dealing with now as to how do we really leverage this regulation, Section 342, when it comes to addressing the regulated entities. And there are a couple of conflicting, maybe not conflicting, but different organizations, especially when you talk about the private sector outside of the financial institutions that we govern. You know, the EEOC has primary responsibility for those, and the Office of Federal Contract Compliance also has a hand in monitoring and regulating and evaluating how private sector folks are doing, you know, especially those that have any government work, government contracts are doing, with their diversity and you know, diversity of their workforce and the diversity of their contracting. What we've been tasked to do is to kind of add on to that and figure out ways to look at the financial institutions themselves and say, okay, based on your size, based on your dealing with, if you have federal contracts, what does your workforce look like? And by the way, are you doing contracting with minority and women-owned small businesses in your sphere of influence? Are you what does your workforce look like on the ground in your financial institution? So it's a little bit it's not as clear as it probably could be, because you have a number of different agencies that have a piece of the action.
Yeah, so it sounds, unfortunately, this is, I think, typical government, right? And no disrespect to the government, but it's kind of disjointed. There's the efficiency, the synergies aren't really being capitalized because there are all these different parts that have a piece of this legislation. And so I would think that your office, at least, was part of that vision, was to bring all that together and to empower this effort of ensuring that these opportunities are being made available to minorities and women.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And the one thing that we're doing, all the OMRI directors, all of us, we know each other. We knew each other when we were EEO directors or diversity directors for the most part. So we have a good working relationship. We've been working together since the legislation was passed. So we are now involved in an effort to address this whole area of regulated entities, and have been working with Congresswoman Waters and her staff, and with to get guidance from her as to what she's looking for, and also when you're talking about developing standards to assess the diversity of these regulated entities, the one thing that we have to remember is that, you have all sizes of regulated entities, and it's not just me and the FDIC's financial institutions, but you've got the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, you've got the Federal Reserve, you've got the SEC, who has about 20,000 people that are considered as individual regulated entities. So it's a big ballpark that you're talking about trying to pull together and come up with some consistency. So, we're trying to develop now ways to make something that's sensible, that we can utilize across all of these different boundaries. How do you go to a community bank in Minot, North Dakota, versus J.P. Morgan Chase or Bank of America, and come up with some things that are reasonable? So it's a challenge. We're working on it, and I think when we get finished with this, we will have something that's very useful for us to use. It'll provide the kind of information that the Congresswoman wants, and it'll provide assistance to a lot of these financial institutions that we really haven't been able to provide, you know, like technical assistance or guidance or best practices on how to deal with things. So it's interesting. We held a bunch of roundtables with financial institutions of different sizes, and it's amazing to sit in a room and listen to some of their descriptions of how they address diversity issues, inclusion issues, you know, in their institutions.
Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of reminds me of the whistleblower laws. Until they were tightened up and people would be protected, their jobs would be protected, you know, a lot of companies would get away with a lot of stuff. And until people were able to take matters up without fear of losing their job, and it's still not a perfect law, and there are still consequences when you blow the whistle on anyone. But it seems to me that with the size of the FDIC, with all the various departments, and then the size of all these financial institutions, I mean, individually and collectively, it is a big job to try to know and understand what's happening in these companies and these organizations that are contracting with the federal government. Are they discriminating? Are they not? Is there a real program for inclusion of minorities and women, or is there not? And I think one way to assist the federal government is to be engaged with many organizations that are, as organizations go, are very new still, with the exception of maybe one. Of course, you are aware of NAREP, the National Association of Real Estate Brokers,
right.
Began in 1947, and also the NAACP, which you are very involved in, the NAACP, and these organizations, you know, came to be as a result of discrimination and things of that nature. Well, since then, we have the Asian Real Estate Association of America. We have the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals. We have women organizations, like you were just recently on a year ago with the National Association of Women REO Brokers, Desiree Patino. And then you have WINS, the Women in Default Services, with Shelley Kay. And so these are organizations who are on the front line. They have people, minorities predominantly, who are trying to get these opportunities. What can the government do, and particularly FDIC, do to better partner with these organizations to be somewhat of a watchdog, if you will, and bring to your attention the lack of opportunity, or perhaps the challenges in trying to receive opportunity?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, some of the organizations that you mentioned have been involved in these outreach meetings that we've been having to help us, you know, to develop these assessment tools. So NAREB was at a meeting we had last month. NAACP, a number of organizations that have an interest. You know, we went out to all of the advocacy groups, the professional groups. You know, we've gotten a lot of feedback from them, and so they've been kind of at the table. It's been in our thinking all along that we need to get that kind of input up front from all these organizations, you know, before we commit to developing some kinds of assessment tools or standards or measurements, you know, and just all of a sudden just dropping it on everybody. We wanted to get the input first, you know, and do it in the reverse of what happens a lot of times. You know, you put out something and then you ask for the input. We're asking for the input before we develop these standards. So We've been touching base with them and sitting down with them in these roundtables. We had about 8 or 9 of them around the country in the last four or five months.
Well, Michael, I'm so happy you're on this call with us today to talk about these things. And folks, for those of you who are on Blog Talk Radio, we want to give you an opportunity to ask questions of Michael. We have a few more questions to go, but I certainly want to open the phone lines to those of you who would like to ask Michael a question directly. Now, some have already done that, and I have too many questions that I'm actually going to be able to get to. And I don't have a screener today, so you're going to have to state your name when I bring you on the line. And so please don't have your phone on mute to be ready to talk to me.